what in the world's going on with the drugging of children. I'll just give you that as a tease. You can find out who it is by going and looking at the frequent alert for this week, and went up a day or so ago and checking it out. It's really getting interesting out there. Meanwhile, don't forget things like nature, things like trees and ponds and creeks and flowers and birds. Today, I was working on a report for a law case. It was a lot of hard work, and I looked out my window, and a place where Ginger had just recently hung an orange on the deck outside my window, a female oriole came and just pulled out all she could get from that orange. And then the male arrived, and she left. He got on the orange, and he just kept pulling on it and sucking up all that nectar, I think they think it is. And things like that keep a man or a woman, a person, just in touch with a lot that matters outside ourselves. I walked down to a little waterfall, it's really little, the creek that runs through my property, and we'd had a big storm the night before, and beautiful today, and the water was tumbling out. And Ginger had said, "I hope it didn't wash away the frogs," but there they were, a couple of bullfrogs. We usually have a few of them. And one of them I watched swim off. I don't usually get the sight of them swimming, usually just hear a kerplunk. And I went down to see if any fish were being pushed over the waterfall. We have a little fish and some fish up to 8 or 9 inches. I saw a great blue heron came in our little tiny pond and pulled out an 8 or 9 inch fish this week. Looked like a trout, but I didn't know we had any trout in there. I think we have some small largemouth bass coming down from a pond above us. And as I looked at the waterfall, I saw something I've never seen before, inexplicable to me. Instead of fish coming over this little waterfall, there were little tiny fish, 1 inch long fish, just popping up in the air trying to get off the waterfall. Bing, and then wait a little, bing, and then bing, bing. And they would just fly in the air and fall back. The waterfall's about 2.5 feet high. They didn't look like they were getting up it. I don't know whether these are folks that were washed down or were little guys practicing coming up to spawn in the pond. I just have no idea what these little fish are, 1 inch long, popping up right at the foot of the waterfall, right in all the broiling because it's running a little faster than usual. Anyway, it's stuff like this that can keep a person's head together, keep you in touch with nature, with God, with anything else you think is just really important out there. Now, let me go to my guest. You there, Patrick?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Patrick. This is Patrick D. Hahn. D as in, I don't know,
Daniel.
Dan. Patrick D. Hahn. Pat's been on the show a couple of times now, and he really does always leave me with new ideas. I was looking back at the write-ups I've done on the shows, and they just contained interesting stuff that I've continued to be interested in that seemed to just come to a head when he and I talk. He's affiliate professor of biology at Loyola University in Maryland, and he's a freelance writer. He's an educator. And he's now working on a book, finishing up a book on madness and genetic determinism, is mental illness in our genes. And we may get a bit more scientific than we do sometimes today and really dig into some interesting and frightening historical issues. I'm going to unleash Patrick. And by the way, you can find him online at Patrick D. Hahn, Science Writer. Patrick D. Hahn, Hahn, Science Writer. But I'm just going to unleash Patrick, and I think I'm going to have lots to think about because he's going to be bringing up stuff that I've also written about, and I think we'll have an interesting time together. So welcome back on the show. It's
Yes, it's good to be
always
back.
interesting. Yeah, it's good to have you on, Patrick. So you pick up this thread anywhere you want.
Okay, yes. Well, this is my first book. As you said, the title is Madness and Genetic Determinism, is Mental Illness in Our Genes? And I think it's very timely. Every month, it seems, there's a new story claiming that scientists have found the gene for schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or some other mental illness. And I don't think the majority of readers really understand what that means, and I'm hoping I can shed some light on the matter and clear the confusion. So, of course, that's not... So my book begins, it's not really a recent concern. People have been talking about these things for the last 250 years. So my book goes back to the beginning of the asylum era. And, well, the first mental institution, Bethlehem Hospital in London, that was housing mental patients at least 600 years ago. But it was the only one of its kind until the second half of the 18th century. And presumably with the Industrial Revolution, more and more people migrating to cities. And people who couldn't fit in, they no longer had these, there was a decline in the multi-generational households that used to care for people who couldn't fit in. So they had to find something to do with these people, so they began building mental hospitals. And, of course, these places required, well, they didn't call them hospitals originally, asylums. And, of course, every asylum needed its doctor. And in 1809, the German asylum doctor, Johann Reil, coined the term psychiatry for this specialty. And that comes from the Greek words meaning the healing of the soul. And a lot of these asylum doctors reported just great success with what they called moral therapy. Exercise, fresh air, sunlight, good food, order, structure, discipline, kindness. And but as the 19th century wore on and went into the 20th century, these places became dumping grounds for criminals, vagrants, orphans, people with alcoholic dementia, syphilitic dementia, the mentally retarded. And that was when they morphed into the crowded, filthy snake pits of popular imagination. And that was, it was in the second half of the 19th century that they began seriously talking about the hereditary basis of mental illness. And let's try to have some sympathy for these asylum doctors faced with what must have looked to them like this flood tide of the dregs of humanity. And so there were calls to keep them from reproducing. The term schizophrenia, and I've chosen to focus on schizophrenia in my book because that's generally considered to be the most severe and intractable mental illness, and also the one most likely to have a biological or genetic basis. So if we find a genetic basis for this condition, that would bolster the case for looking for a genetic basis for other mental illnesses. And if genetic determinist arguments fail for schizophrenia, they're likely to fail for other mental illnesses as well. So the term schizophrenia was coined by the Swiss psychiatrist, he was French, I believe, Eugen Bleuler. And one of his students, and he said he said it was hereditary condition, and he said we must take action or our race must rapidly degenerate. And one of his proteges, Ernst Rudin, heard this call and made this his life's work. So I've got a whole chapter on Rudin. Rudin was actually born in Switzerland, but he spent most of his career in Germany. And right after Hitler came to power, Rudin was made the head of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Psychiatry. And so he wrote the German law for the sterilization of the mentally ill. In fairness, I probably ought to point out that this law was patterned after similar laws already in effect in the United States. So the idea of sterilizing people who were labeled mentally ill did not originate with the Nazis.
You know, as you probably know, yeah. Patrick, some Americans led by Paul Popenoe, who was a family planning expert and who was in California and was the statistician for all the sterilizations going on in the mental hospitals, involuntary sterilizations. They went over and met with Rudin, and I don't know if they ever got to see the Fuhrer, but they met with the top-ranked people and reassured them that they wouldn't run into any international uproar for the first laws passed under the Third Reich, which were the sterilization laws, that because it was so acceptable in the U.S. and Great Britain.
And they had over 300,000 to 400,000 patients sterilized, and something like maybe 1,500, 2,000 of them died of complications. Sometimes they sterilized people who just when by x-rays without their knowledge when they were standing behind a counter filling out forms.
That started in the U.S. and not in the Nazi concentration camps?
No, in Germany.
In Germany, okay.
In Germany.
Right.
Yeah. So, then we... And this one of Rudin's proteges, Franz Kalman, he decided to go one step further. And this is one of my favorite anecdotes in the book. He, at the International Congress on Population Problems, Kalman got up and he claimed that schizophrenia was caused by a recessive gene. And he said, we need to sterilize not just all the people with schizophrenia, but all of their relatives who had a single copy of this imagined schizophrenia gene. And at this point, Fritz Lenz rose to point out the absurdity of Kalman's proposal. Now, Lenz was professor of genetics. He was himself an ardent Nazi and eugenicist, so he wasn't against eugenics in principle, but he rose and pointed out the absurdity of what Kalman was saying. He said, if this condition is caused by a recessive gene and 1% of the population is schizophrenic, and you want to sterilize all the heterozygotes, all the people with one copy of the gene, that means you're going to have to sterilize one person out of every five. And so that proposal was shelved, but the sterilization program went on full speed ahead. And
Kalman eventually came to the U.S. I suspect he had a Jewish parent. Because
yes,
as a
that's
Jew,
exactly
one of the things
right.
I've noticed is that some of the worst eugenicists that came over didn't really want to leave Germany. They just felt they had to, and I think mostly they just had a relative who was Jewish. And Kalman comes over here, folks, after being kind of rejected as too radical by the Nazis, and he's adored in America. I mean, he's just all over the place. He's the scientist in America, and it just shows you how far American psychiatry was actually at that point, and worldwide psychiatry, how close it was to the thinking going on in Germany, or even more radical in some ways. They didn't even do lobotomies in Germany the way they did them in the U.S.
Yeah. Kalman fled Germany one step ahead of the Gestapo, and so he arrived in New York City with 20 Reichsmarks in his pocket, and but he had some connections, so he became a professor at Columbia University. And you might think that being on the wrong end of eugenics policies would have dampened Kalman's enthusiasm for the subject, but it did not. He more or less single-handedly founded the discipline of psychiatric eugenics in America. And I talk about his book on twin studies. Here he's talking about schizoid psychopaths, the category he calls schizoid psychopaths, which according to him includes, quote, the unsociable, cold-hearted, indecisive, and fanatic types regarded by Schneider as the prototypes of the catanoid, heboid, schizoid, and paranoid cases, as well as Hoffman's bullheaded oafs, malicious tyrants, queer cranks, over-pedantic schemers, prudish model children, and daydreamers out of all touch with reality, end quote. Now, that is not the language of science. That is not the language of medicine. That is the language of a man who is consumed with hatred towards his fellow man and has set himself on a quest to remove what he sees as the source of that anger and hatred.
I really agree with you, and I think that one of the things that's so clear is that when you look at the extreme people in psychiatry, they're extremely abusive and hateful human beings. The shock doctors, the lobotomists, the eugenicists, they're not nice folks by and large. Don't know a lot of them personally, so I'm having to deduce a lot of that. But, you know, that's one more example of it.
Yeah, and Kalman's book on twin studies came out in 1938. And so he begins by thanking his former boss, Ernst Rudin, and rather circumspectly notes, political developments in Germany closed to me the possibility to complete my research there. Yeah, no kidding. And so he became the big name in twin studies, and I go into that. I've got a whole chapter on twin studies, and the studies are, I argue, are fatally flawed. And I've talked to a fellow, Jay Joseph. He's a clinical psychologist in San Francisco, and he's written several books on psychiatric genetics and twin studies. And I agree with him. These studies, they don't prove anything. And just repeating the same inconclusive studies still doesn't prove anything. You got a bucket with no bottom in it, you're not going to be able to carry water in it. And if you have three buckets like that, or 100 buckets like that, you're still not going to be able to carry water. But, so Kalman went on to found psychiatric eugenics in America. In his book, he made it clear that he did not support the kind of mandatory sterilization program that was going on in Germany at the time. He recommended counseling and education, with mandatory sterilization being reserved only for those recalcitrants who would not accept voluntary sterilization.
God.
Yeah. And
would you say that he ever got any serious criticism from inside the academic community? Way back then, when does he, do you know enough? I don't know to know when he starts to get criticized. I mean, I did.
I don't think it was until the 80s. Yeah, he died in 1965. And here's his obituary. The distinguished career of Franz J. Kalman as a researcher and teacher came to a close with his death on May 12th, 1965. His contributions to the field of human genetics were established with his classic work on the genetics of schizophrenia. By 1936, his opposition to Nazi laws requiring compulsory sterilization of mentally ill patients had made his position in his native Germany scientifically untenable. Wow, is that ever a lie?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, there's a wonderful book by, came out in the 80s, Not in Our Genes. It was by a geneticist, a neurobiologist, R.C. Lewontin. He's a geneticist. Stephen Rose and Leon J. Kamen. And yeah, they really raked Rudin and Kalman over the coals. And I agree that all the I don't doubt something's being passed on here from generation to generation, but it's not a gene for schizophrenia or any other mental illness. In fact, in researching this book, I came across with an old study more than 50 years ago, and they looked at the adopted away children of schizophrenic mothers, and a small minority of them had schizophrenia, much greater excess than the general population, but still a small minority, and a greater number had other mental illnesses. And what about the ones who were not mentally ill? And they looked at them. They were unusually creative people. So these genes, which predispose individuals to mental illness in the wrong environment, can, in the wrong environment, make people unusually creative people. Yeah, and there's, of course, we can't talk about the, you know, a discussion of the era of twin studies is complete without a discussion of the Genane quadruplets, whom I first learned about in your book, Toxic Psychiatry. And in a way, it's like the story of the Kallikak family. It was supposed to illustrate the primacy of heredity, but in fact, ended up telling much more about its chroniclers than about its purported subjects.
That's a good way to put it.
So the word Genane, oh, go ahead.
No, yeah, that's really a good way to put it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
It's Genane, amazing what they did to, go ahead.
Yeah, Genane is a pseudonym, of course, comes from the Greek words meaning dire birth. And they were a set of identical quadruplets born in 1932. And all four of them were diagnosed with schizophrenia in their mid-20s. And they brought them to the National Institute of Health for 3 years. And they subjected them to just a battery of tests. And they had this enormous book produced about them, edited by David Rosenthal. And Rosenthal was a research psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health. And there were 25 different authors contributed to this volume: psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, a geneticist, a sociologist, a statistician, a social science analyst, a physiologist, and a handwriting analyst. And this book is over 600 pages in length. It's huge. And they tell the story of their childhood. It goes on for 125 pages, and it is a horror story. This was a story of a horrendous abuse that began literally when these girls were in the cradle and continued right up until the time they're taken to the National Institute of Mental Health. Their father, he's identified as Henry in the volume, And he once, when the girls were 8 or 9 months old, he knocked their heads together, he said, to keep them from crying. And these girls were abused physically, sexually, emotionally. This guy, who Henry, the father, he was probably, he was very likely involved in a murder. Go into that in the book. He once fired a gun at his wife. He didn't hit her, but he put a hole through her nightgown. And he said he thought she was a burglar. And these girls, they weren't allowed to have to go over to friends' houses or even visit relatives to engage in after-school activities, talk on the phone, work after-school jobs, and they were most certainly forbidden ever to date or marry. All four were raped or sexually assaulted, one of them in childhood and the other three as young women in their 20s. This guy, they call Henry, you know what his job was? He was a constable. He was a cop. And when his daughter was raped, what did this tough guy with his badge and gun, who was obsessed with his daughter's virginity, do about this? Nothing. He just sneered at her, just shut up and go back to work. Cruel and cowardly is not a real winning combination, is it?
Yeah, let me,
so anyway,
let me just sort of
they brought these
take
young
a break
women
here
to the NIH and,
say,
and yeah, they did every kind of test
Patrick's
on them.
What Patrick's talking about is real. It is so far out that it has to be re-emphasized that this is a book that was put out by our government, really, by all these NIMH, NIH people, trying to prove and supposedly proving that schizophrenia was genetic. And if you read this tome, rather than just reading the intro and the summary, it's a story of just disgraceful child abuse, horrific child abuse. And remember, all you're going to get out of this kind of background is the tip of the iceberg, the tip. The father sexually brutalizing, physically brutalizing, restricting the children. That's the tip. God knows what else was going on. And then think about the lack of connection, loving connection. We forget that when we talk about abuse. It goes along with the rejection and humiliation and a lack of love. And all these guys, how many did you say there were, Patrick, involved in the book? I'd forgotten that
number. Yeah, 25.
25 people involved in a manuscript which is doing nothing but documenting horrendous child abuse. And instead of they're all going and trying to have this guy arrested and put away, they're going to overlook all of this in the interest of promoting biological psychiatry. And this is what it takes to maintain biological psychiatry. Takes liars and cheats and abusers who are at least people who go along and ignore abuse. Bah. It's just
not one of these 25
looking at all this again, Patrick. Go ahead.
Yeah, not one of these 25 psychologists, psychiatrists, and so forth ever asks the obvious question. Who wouldn't be crazy after surviving that horror show of a childhood?
Yeah, these are miracle children that they're functioning at all.
Yeah. And, so, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it makes you want to have a theory of human nature that can explain not the victims who are being called genetically defective, but to explain the researchers.
And Rosenthal went on to become the big name in adoption studies, probably the biggest name. And he did this study in Denmark and just went on for years and years, and they just produced piles of papers. And this study still, to this day, is held up.
Were they connected to NIMH, or was that my mistake?
Yeah, it was a cooperation, NIMH and researchers in Denmark.
Okay.
Yeah, they looked at Denmark, and to this day, it's being held up in as proof that these conditions are hereditary. Schizophrenia is hereditary, and in their last paper, they themselves, Rosenthal and his colleagues, admitted they didn't find a genetic basis for schizophrenia. Their results were negative. But it's still being cited, that work is still being cited as proof of the genetic basis of schizophrenia. And so now, of course, we've got the era of genome-wide association studies. And for this book, I went to JHMI, Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions, and talked with one of their researchers. He's not a psychiatrist or any kind of medical doctor. He's a biochemist, and he studies the normal development of the brain. So schizophrenia genetics is just a small part of his work, but he showed me around his lab, and I got to talk to his assistants. And so now we have this technique of, and he showed me his two-photon microscope. I figured you'd be interested in hearing about this. They can visualize the workings of a million neurons at a time, but they don't have the computing power to handle this data. So he's working with Hopkins scientists who work with the Hubble Space Telescope, trying to find a way to handle all this data. So I figured you'd be interested in hearing about this. The same computing power that's used to comprehend the entire physical universe that astronomers study is now being applied to try to understand the workings of one brain, and not even the brain of a human being, the brain of a mouse. So I'd be curious to know what you think about that.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you bring it up, because one of the things I always want people to remember is that your brain's more complicated than the entire physical universe. That is, the workings of the physical universe pale besides the hundreds of millions, then ultimately trillions of interactions that can go on, that do go on inside a human brain when the billions of neurons are interacting with the trillions of the connectivities that are going on. And that's why we don't have an Einstein of the brain. We don't have a Newton of the brain. I mean, we barely have a Bernini of the brain, because it's so beyond us at this point that we don't know anything about the operating system. We don't know how a human brain participates in the creation of a word, a thought, an idea, an image. We're just very gross, like, you know, well, something about this is happening this place in the brain, but then again, there's a 100 other things happening in that place, probably an infinite number of things happening in that same place of the brain. So the brain is just so complicated. Life, and as you said, you know, I think you said, you know, this little mouse or rat has still got a mammalian brain like we do, and that is just complicated beyond the universe itself, because that's what life is like. It's we need to be in awe of ourselves, just treasure our brains, stop doing bad things to them, another thing, treasure our brains, and be in awe of ourselves, and stop all this reductionism. I know practically everybody listening to this agrees with me, so all I'm trying to do is give you a little extra inspiration. Go on, Patrick. Yeah. Hahn. Again, we're talking with Patrick D. Hahn, and he's working on a new book that's near completion, and it's just going to cover a lot. It is covering a lot of important things. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, so for a century now, we've had these studies, family studies, twin studies, adoption studies, and the people doing the studies say they prove there's a genetic basis to mental illness, and they've had their critics who say that the studies are all fatally flawed and can't be believed. So they've been back and forth for more than 50 years now. But now we have the new technique of genome-wide association studies. And so they've gone over the genome with a fine-tooth comb. And they haven't found any gene that causes schizophrenia or any other mental illness. And they're not going to find any because they don't exist. And you keep hearing about these schizophrenia genes in the popular media. And that's not what they call them in the scientific literature. They call them schizophrenia-associated alleles, which doesn't tell you how strong the association is. But these schizophrenia-associated alleles, they're correlated with an absolute increase in risk. If you on the order of at 1 in 500 on down. And so I asked, I told you I talked with a schizophrenia genetics researcher, a very smart guy, by the way. And I asked him, if you took a test and you found you had a gene that was correlated with a 1 in 500 increase in your chances of developing schizophrenia, what would you do differently? And he said, probably nothing. So, yeah, I talk about him in the book. I hope it's a sympathetic portrait. I'm all in favor of basic research. I'm just
and against, I also don't want people grabbing on to that there is an actual 1 in 500 correlation or association or whatever. Yeah. I mean, it gets to the point of, are you going to really believe these things at all, because somebody's saying it or somebody says they've said it and is using a math that ordinary folks can't possibly understand and that other people probably aren't interested in, and on and on and on. So don't get lost in these numbers. Just look at them and say, this is ridiculous. This is an absolutely ridiculous, desperate attempt to remain in the ball game. Hey, yeah. Coach, we got a 1 in 500 chance of winning this one. Don't give up on us.
Yeah. So, yeah, but I'm all in favor of basic research. I'm just against people misinterpreting the results of research to sell us all as many drugs as possible. That's why at the age of 51 I went back to school to get a degree in science writing.
Basic research. Patrick, don't we need to challenge whether there's even a basic research anymore? Because all the research is known in advance. They're looking for fame and glory and a ton of money from drug companies.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we have much in the way of basic research anymore. None of it is funded. The funding of basic research is research that has no political drive behind it's probably growing more and more minuscule. Maybe 1 in 500, 1 in 5,000, 1 in 5 million will pronounce some new figure. But folks, see, what's happened is that all that gets funded now is, quote, applied research, pretty much. And what is applied research? It's purposeful development of stuff you want to happen. That's very much like the so-called research that the drug companies do to prove their drugs work. It's got such a loaded goal that it isn't even research. It's an attempt to prove something regardless of the facts. So I've just become so skeptical now. We're losing track in this universe where it touches anywhere on profits and politics and human behavior. It's very hard to find anything that really looks like basic research. Does that make sense to you, Patrick, or am I going too far for you?
Yeah, sure. But, I mean, it's, they could have said, okay, people don't understand what's meant by the phrase, it's genetic. I think most people, when they hear that phrase, they think back to their high school genetics. Okay, if the pea plant has the gene for purple flowers, it will have purple flowers. If it does not have the gene for purple flowers, it will not have purple flowers. So the odds ratio, if you like, is infinity, or at least astronomically large. And these so-called mental illness genes are not like that at all, correlated with these tiny chances, like I said, 1 in 500 on down. And I asked the fellow, his name is Richard Hugenier, by the way, I asked him, why do you think these genes have been conserved by natural selection? He said, well, they're also correlated with increased creativity. So that goes back to that study I was talking about from the 60s that found the offspring of schizophrenic birth mothers in the wrong environment were more likely to develop schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But in the right environment.
I think all the way back in Toxic, I probably said that one of the most characteristic things about the young people who come to me and who are hallucinating and having delusions and are really lost souls, at least for the moment, that these folks tend to be the people with whom I can have the most interesting conversations. They're not only the most intelligent in the family, but even more so, they're the most creative and imaginative. And I think way back then I talked about folks who get labeled schizophrenic as being broken poets. Otherwise, if you're going to break down and you're not very creative, you don't break down into hallucinations and delusions and other things. You break down into something more mundane, like being horribly depressed or horribly obsessive or, you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
But to end up creating an alternative reality is a creation. And I think often there's a fundamental difference in the child born into the family, and it has to do with just something. I don't know if it's genetic, by the way. I'm not necessarily saying it's even genetic, but there's something about that human being that has a viewpoint of her own, a viewpoint of his own, a way of being that may be more loving or more intense or more truth-devoted that runs into dreadful problems with not necessarily an abusive family, but an ordinary family.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I get into the question, so if it's not genes that are causing this, what is causing this? And to look at the question of sexual abuse and other kinds of adverse childhood experiences. Now, Sigmund Freud wrote about this back in the 1890s. And he had these patients come to him, and they said they were sexually with hysteria, which back then was kind of a catch-all term for any kind of mental illness. And they said they had been sexually abused, always beginning before the age of 8. And so he published 3 papers on this subject. And then a year later, without ever explaining why, he just changed his mind. He said, nope. There was no abuse. These were just infantile fantasies. Now, let's take a moment to consider how bizarre Freud's position is at this point. So, because he was adamant that these mental illnesses were real diseases, no less than smallpox. That was his comparison. And now he's saying that these real brain diseases were caused by events that never happened. That's not even coherent. And there's a bizarre postscript to all this.
That's very well put. That is very well. I want to tarry on that a minute. That he's saying he's a physician, so he's using a physical model. He wants to be a physician. He's trained as a neurologist. He really wants a researcher, and he really wants to have a physical basis. And now he's saying that imagination is making people crazy. False memories are making people crazy. I never thought of it that way. That's really very, very interesting.
Yeah, and there's a bizarre postscript to all this. In 1932, almost 40 years later, one of Freud's protégés, Sandor Ferenczi, gave a talk at the International Psychoanalytic Congress. And like Freud, he had patient after patient come into his office and claim that terrible things had been done to them as small children. Unlike Freud, He had a ready answer for anyone who would dismiss these experiences as infantile fantasies, because he'd also had patient after patient come into his office and confess to having done these things to small children. So by then, Freud was too sick to attend, but most of the other leading lights in psychoanalysis were there. And Ferenczi gave his talk, which, as you might expect, was not enthusiastically received. But Ernest Jones, the president of the International Psychoanalytic Association, promised to have his paper published in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. But then, less than a year later, Ferenczi died of pernicious anemia, and Jones went back on his word and had the proofs of Ferenczi's paper destroyed.
We do. We need a theory of human nature, right? Something about evil to explain so much of what we see in our field. Ferenczi was a shining light and so different from Freud. He believed, really believed in love and caring and in relationship and really being honest and honorable with your patients and having good conversations with them. I mean, he was a prince, as far as I can tell, compared to a lot of these other guys. And this and that's so interesting. I didn't know that story and about what happened to his paper, and it just makes a lot of sense. Fits in with so much. It was Jeffrey Mason, a friend of mine over the years. He's been overseas. I haven't seen him in a long time. But, Jeffrey, who blew the whistle on Freud and said that the reason he changed his viewpoint was simply that he got shunned by his colleagues when he kept talking about child abuse, and then practically overnight he said it was not child abuse, they made it up. You can imagine how many abusers were among his colleagues. And then what happened is Jeffrey got attacked viciously by the psychoanalytic community here in modern times and by relatives of the psychoanalysts. And it's just one long history of hiding child abuse. It really took, I think, the feminists in the 60s and women in the 60s to start, in general, to start writing about abuse and to really bring it out. It did not come out of the psychotherapists. It came out of women telling their stories. It came out of women who were doing sociological kinds of studies and doing feminist studies. Very interesting and dismaying history.
Yeah, and Dr. Mason, when he was writing his book, he shared his findings with Freud's daughter, Anna, and she wrote to him, here I'm quoting, "Keeping up the seduction theory would mean to abandon the Oedipus complex and with it the whole importance of fantasy life, conscious or unconscious fantasy. In fact, I think there would have been no psychoanalysis afterwards," end quote. And I read that and I thought, she may be right about that. Instead of inventing complexes and drives out of thin air, the way modern day psychiatrists invent chemical imbalances out of thin air, maybe they would have turned their attention to real life problems created by real life suffering. Mm-hmm. Who knows how different the world today might be as a result?
Well, and folks, again, you know, Patrick knows so much, and he goes over things that not everybody will know a lot of the history of. So what he's saying, and what is absolutely true, is that Freud literally decided that, or at least promoted that, and made the basis of psychoanalysis not that abuse was what was bringing people to him, but that their false fantasies about wanting to have sex with their uncles, aunts, grandfathers, big brothers, that these people wanted, fantasized having sex, and in fact they were never abused. What a whopper of a lie and a distraction. And I remember reading that as a youngster, because I started reading Freud pretty early, and thinking to myself, that is absolutely ridiculous. It's obviously adults who have these interests in children. Children aren't attracted to adults sexually. You just look around the world. That is not what goes on. They're attracted to their peers.
Yeah.
And to be able to make that twist. But I agree with you again that she's probably right, that if Freud had come out and said the truth, that this was child abuse, we would not have heard of him very much again. He's one more sellout. He sold out women, he sold out children, he sold out the human race. Ah. Boy, I'm saying that a lot today.
Ah. Yeah, in writing this book, what struck me again and again is the adroitness of psychiatrists and psychologists in ignoring the evidence that is literally right before their eyes. Here's Don Jackson. He was an early critic of genetic theories of the origin of schizophrenia. He was a pioneer in the use of psychotherapy to treat psychotic symptoms. But even he tiptoed around the subject of out-and-out abuse. Here's his 1960 book chapter talking about the cause of schizophrenia. Quote, assuredly, it is nothing as obvious as beatings, rape, poverty, or the overgeneralized notion of rejection, end quote. And the same chapter, he talks about two male identical twins who suffered from the same fear of choking on a banana, and two female identical twins who suffered from the same fear of being poisoned by semen. And he never makes a connection that maybe this had to do with their real life experiences.
Isn't that sad? Isn't that dismaying? Folks, human beings have a great deal of trouble looking at the truth. And when they have power, when they have influence, it becomes so hard for most human beings to look beyond self-interest, beyond their identity, beyond how they make a living, beyond how they might get famous, and to simply say, what is true? What is true about how human beings relate to each other? What's the truth? How much abuse is there? How much oppression is there? How much love is there? What is the battle between love, freedom, and the good things, and coercion and hatred and abuse? And these are huge subjects, and of course people have very differing answers to all of this. But when we look at the so-called behavioral sciences, what we see again and again, whether you call it psychology or psychiatry or mental health or behavioral sciences, is a flight from reality, not on the part of the patients, whose fantasies are often have more to do with reality of their abuse, or whose delusions or whose hallucinations have more to do with the realities of their lives than a fantasies being concocted by the people who are supposedly understanding them and treating them. Yeah, Patrick, you always influence me to just think harder. And it's just a pleasure having you on. We've got only a few minutes to go, and I'd like you to think about what you might like to leave us with in a minute or two.
Well, okay. I talked to a woman who had been horribly abused as a child by her older brother, and this was followed by decades of abuse at the hands of the psychiatric profession. And I asked her, what did you wish those around you when you were a child had done differently? And she did not hesitate a moment before answering. Here's her quote. There is a really simple solution called love. Love those children, okay? Watch out for them. Know the signs. Abuse happens behind closed doors, and it happens more than people know.
That's a very, very, very good way to slow this down, to mull on this. This is the kind of show that will, that gets me thinking, and it'll help get other folks thinking. It's always very important to have you on, and make sure you get on regularly, Patrick. And I wish you good luck with the book. Maybe somebody's listening who might want to take a look at that book and has some connection. We just need a lot of material out there that continues to document this evil, corrupt, it's not an underbelly, it's a heart or a soul or something that keeps cropping up in the work we look at of people trying to help people with their problems. Thank you so much for being on the show. Patrick Hahn, H-A-H-N, Patrick D. Hahn. Be sure to look up his website. And thank you again for being on. Good luck with your book.
Okay, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.